Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and new Let It Roll intern Ivan DeHaas conclude the Three Kings of Emo Rap series with a look at the Juice WRLD documentary, Into the Abyss. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and once again, we're welcoming back Let It Roll intern Ivan DeHaas to conclude our trilogy on the Three Kings of Emo Rap. Today, we're looking at Juice WRLD, Into the Abyss, which is a documentary made for HBO Max, directed by Tommy Oliver. Ivan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Nate. Thanks again for having me on.
And so, Juice WRLD, is he the most talented of the three, at least in the sense of being a tradition as a rapper? Like, he's a freestyle king, like one of the few rappers of this generation I've seen get respect from the old school lyrical rappers.
Absolutely. I would say that, from my own personal perceptions of him and from others, based on not only clips from the Into the Abyss documentary, but from clips that were always surfacing online during his career run and, obviously years after his death, that was really one of his main appeals for his raw talent, his ability to just kind of provide those almost stream of consciousness freestyles right off the top of his head.
Yeah, and it reminds me of Tupac Shakur, who famously recorded a whole double album the day he got out of prison. That kind of old school lyrical freestyler. But and not to knock Lil Peep or Extension, who I think made very powerful music. They were just coming from a different place. They were not traditional lyrical rappers. And Lil Peep, I would say, is more like an emo rocker who used trap beats really more than a lyrical rapper in the old school sense. But let's give a quick who, what, why, or who, what, when, where stuff about Juice WRLD. Who was he? How did he get famous? How big did he get? And what happened to him?
Well, I mean, Juice WRLD's career in music really just started out as a guy in a high school in Chicago, recognizing that, they mentioned in the documentary, Juice recognized he was, average at, more or less everything involving, sports and school related things that he did growing up. But the one thing that really personally stuck out to him and to other people that was exceptional pertaining to his talents was always relevant to music. He started, he learned the piano from the age of four and also, tried his hands at playing the guitar, drums, and played the trumpet in school. But it was really during his sophomore year of high school that he focused his efforts within music on making hip hop and putting it online. So, around the mid 2010s, 2014, 2015, he started posting songs on SoundCloud in his sophomore year of high school. And this online platform allowed him to catch the eye of an internet blog that also produced music videos on YouTube. It gave it gave shed light usually on up and coming artists. And the name of the channel and the blog was Lyrical Lemonade. And the director for the music videos and one of the co-founders of Lyrical Lemonade, Cole Bennett, you know, the song All Girls Are the Same was really his first song that that gained popularity. And it was through Lyrical Lemonade, who, you know, basically promoted the song on their blog. And then in early, you know, the next year, Cole Bennett actually filmed a video for All Girls Are the Same. Name, you know, starring Juice WRLD, and that video blew up on YouTube while the song itself, you know, being released as a single, was getting plenty of numbers on streaming services. So that was really, that was the start of Juice's, what would be a meteoric rise to fame in a very short amount of time. I mean, by the end of 2018, he had a studio album out, you know, had signed a $3 million deal with Interscope and was, you know, was touring around the United States. And pretty much by that point in time, before 2019 even rolled around, he had that that cemented fate as a rising star in the U.S. who's basically had a direct trajectory towards superstardom. And from 2019, the you know, the second album debut, the collaboration with Atlanta rapper Future, and everything else after that, that was more or less proven to be true. Juice WRLD reached a level of superstardom and fame and also commercial popularity that equaled many of the artists who had been releasing music well throughout the early 2010s, the likes of The Weeknd and Drake. A lot of the decade end lists pertaining to streaming saw Juice WRLD's numbers in the span of really only two or three years of making officially released music, matching that of artists who had entire production teams behind him and, you know, higher budgets. He matched the popularity in such a short time and impacted the lives of millions of kids in a, you know, really heartfelt and impressive way.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very impressive to me that, and it was also a testament to the openness of the SoundCloud era. And what we've seen in the course of Let It Roll is there's these brief windows when independent artists have a chance to grab new technologies and new means of distribution and reach mass audiences. And Juice WRLD's a classic example of that. He recorded his first songs on his cell phone, uploaded them to SoundCloud. I presume he acquired beats off SoundCloud as well. And do you know the answer to that one?
Not off the top of my head. I do know he also caught the eye of Nick Mira through SoundCloud. And Nick Mira is one of the guys responsible for a lot of the signature sounds you hear on Goodbye and Good Riddance. A lot of the beats have a similar atmosphere to them. And Nick Mira was someone who was who Juice collabed with in 2017. I believe Nick Mira saw his work on SoundCloud, though, and that's how they got together.
I see. Yeah. So just a classic testament to the SoundCloud era. And also, I think when comparing him to Lil Peep and Extension, Lil Peep died so young that he was pretty underground still. None of his, most of his bigger hits were posthumous. And Extension achieved pretty big popularity, but Juice WRLD was just on another level. Like you said, he was literally competing with Drake and The Weeknd at the absolute top of the field. And then the documentary, of course, is posthumous. And it's very interesting to compare him to Lil Peep and Extension, because Lil Peep, it just became clear over the course of the documentary, he couldn't close his doors. He could not kick people out of his apartment. He could not get rid of hangers-on. And that ultimately contributed to his death. Extension had massive criminal behavior problems and domestic violence problems that were inexorably dragging him into prison, even had he lived. But Juice WRLD, it seems like, had a much more supportive circle. You know, he had a big circle, but a coherent and professional circle, and also a loving circle. He had a life partner that he was married to. And yet the drug problem in this documentary is just staggering. I mean, the Percocets are just flying at all times. Was this known while he was alive?
I think from a perspective of his inner circle, everyone pretty overtly acknowledged the fact that a lot of the, you know, codeine, promethazine usage, as well as the, you know, the Percocet usage within Juice's circle, that was known, but I don't think it was overtly acknowledged as an issue by too many people other than Ali Lottie, his, you know, his girlfriend and wife, later wife, and Juice himself, who in specific clips of the documentary talks about some of the benefits that sobriety could offer with respect to being there for your family. And also Juice is recalling in several places in the documentary how being on drugs so frequently, so often, and such powerful drugs and such a high volume, not only is it, you know, life-threatening and dangerous as the documentary and really Juice WRLD's trajectory shows, it's also, it turns you into a different person. Juice was surrounded by people whom he cared about and whom he enjoyed and who supported him. But I feel like that growing sense of emptiness inside that he talked about in a lot of his music and a lot of the heartbreak, you know, not only romantically related things, but it was also due to the personality shifts from such a large amount of drugs. And, you know, his photographer, personal assistant, and, you know, a few of his label managers talk about not only the issues they saw within Juice pertaining to substance abuse themselves. They talked about how, you know, through Juice's, you know, his medium as a rapper, he was able to communicate the struggles he had with that. And everyone was so impressed by the resulting art that came out of him rapping and singing about his everyday struggles, especially involving these substances. Everyone was paid so much attention to the art and the impact it had that they took their gaze off of the actual Jared Higgins with respect to what sort of impact would this have on him physically, you know, in terms of his actual body, in terms of being able to live longer. And I think that right there best reflects sort of the dynamic with substances within Juice WRLD and his camp.
Yeah, it's definitely a cautionary tale. But let's go ahead and hear some Juice WRLD. This is All Girls Are the Same, the SoundCloud song that broke him through and brought him to the big time. That's Juice WRLD's All Girls Are the Same, his breakthrough single that he dropped on SoundCloud that led to his deal with Interscope Records, led to the Cole Bennett video that led to the Interscope deal. One thing about Juice WRLD that I found interesting, especially given his talents as a freestyle rapper, was he was not a hip-hop native. His mother wouldn't let him listen to hip-hop growing up, so he grew up a lot more on rock and heavy metal than he did on rap. And it definitely shows. Do you think that that's a core of why we see these three artists as constituting a subgenre on their own, is that they had more influences from rock than, say, many trap artists that they're contemporary with?
I think from a vocal and sonic perspective, although definitely I'd say more so vocal in Juice's case, there's a definite influence within the genre of rock, and you know, in some of the other cases like X punk, and I think that definitely constitutes a certain recognition of these three stars, and you know, the people behind them really, as something that definitely deserves a certain removal from, you know, what we would consider the likes of trap music, you know, a lot of other rap subgenres that are also equally as popular around this time have a distinctly different sound from the emo rap subgenre. And I think it's because of those influences on Juice WRLD's music. Although undeniably, in some of the points of the documentary, he mentions how the likes of still Tupac, Biggie, Nas, and Public Enemy are influences and idols of his. There's that, and that's obviously, I think that's present in his approach to freestyles and, you know, also his music. But there's still that element of, you know, genre parallel influence that I think obviously goes beyond rap. And I think that's what distinguishes these three artists, absolutely, is that past musical influence. It's very important to identify and understand, really.
Yeah, and you hear, when you listen to his music, you hear him name check John Lennon and Kurt Cobain as many times or more than any single hip hop figure. So it's and I think that reflects his generation, that Nirvana and the Beatles seem to have penetrated into the Zoomer consciousness in a way that some of their contemporaries, say the Rolling Stones or Pearl Jam, just haven't, which is just interesting to see. And we could puzzle about for a long time. But one other thing I want to pull out from the documentary is that his drug use, according to Juice WRLD, started with the institutions he was in, that he didn't start out as a recreational drug user. He started out as a compulsory drug user because he had been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. And he was on Adderall from the time he was in fifth grade, which is, again, also a very common phenomenon with this generation. Is that something you've seen in your personal life, that the medication of kids that are diagnosed this way, does it correlate to later use of recreational drugs?
I would say there have definitely been instances in my personal life and from my experience with people my age that have been diagnosed with the likes of ADD, ADHD, where when they're put on a medication from an early age, like Juice was, I think he really hit the nail on the head with what he mentions in the documentary, how medication in the context of, you know, there's something abnormal in terms of, you know, either your behavior or something cognitive, and you need to take this in order to straighten it out and, you know, make yourself normal. I've seen that a lot with some of my friends and colleagues. And later on, you know, once we're in high school, college, whatnot, that has led to drug use, I think, on behalf of that being medicated from an early age, you know, situation. And what Juice mentions in the documentary was something that immediately personally resonated with me, because it seems very relevant to the circumstances of a lot of people I know, where from a young age, and especially on behalf of, you know, their parents, you know, taking them for a diagnosis and then, you know, buying the prescription that they are, you know, for example, Adderall for ADD. That in and of itself, I think, normalizes that drug use from an early age. And, you know, it also sort of shows pretty soon after. I mean, Juice was only in sixth grade when he started sipping lean for the first time. And shortly after that, it was trying Xanax, using Xanax, which, you know, is pretty deadly and addictive in and of itself. But that pretty accurately shows how that normalization of reliance on drugs from an early age, I think, can have a pretty devastating effect, not even all that far down the line. I mean, by the time you're in your mid to late teenage years, it seems like turning to substances for the sake of like a mental or emotional solution, or even physical, is normal.
Yeah, it's certainly widespread. And for those who didn't listen to our DJ Screw episode, lean is a mix of soda pop and codeine cough syrup. And opioids like that are especially dangerous if you mix them with drugs like Xanax, which is a drug class called benzodiazepines, which the two opiates and benzos just really shouldn't mix. And there was another temptation. Like, there's an early scene in the movie where he's performing at a major festival, I think it's Flognaw, in late 2018, and he meets Tyler, the Creator, who's, you know, a rap star from the 2000s, 2010s era, and you know, Juice is very respectful, acknowledges his influence, and that seems to touch Tyler, the creator. He also meets Ilo McConnon, who we'll remember from the Lil Peep documentary. McConnon had collaborated with Lil Peep towards the end, and he seems very much charmed by Juice WRLD and impressed with his talent. But they have this conversation, and I'll it's time to cue. So let me cue my next song, and then when we come back, I'll talk about the other temptation of the 2010s that Juice struggled with. But this is Lucid Dreams. This was the song that absolutely broke Juice through to the mainstream. I think it was streamed about a gazillion billion times and massively popular on YouTube. This is Juice WRLD's Lucid Dreams. That was Juice WRLD's Lucid Dreams, the song that just absolutely broke him wide open and made him a mainstream figure. But there's a conversation with Ilo McConnon, and it's a point in the movie and perhaps his life when it seemed like Juice was trying to clean up, and that his wife is especially pressuring him to stay away from the lean. He's trying to cut down the pills, but he feels like the vehicle for temptation, the thing that he most wants to get rid of, is his phone, which he views as just a connection to temptation for people who are trying to, you know, connect him with drugs. And that he's fantasizing about having an iPod Classic where he can just listen to music without being connected. How did that speak to you? Is that something that you feel like people in your generation are struggling with as well as drugs and general depression?
I absolutely think so, because having a phone for someone in Gen Z is without a doubt a double-edged sword. And the interesting part is, you know, my phone broke last week and I felt like I'd lost a limb because of all my two-factor authentication and, you know, bank account information and, you know, password stuff that I use my phone for. But aside from that, the fact that Juice recognizes sort of a lot of the obsessive compulsive habits that come with constantly having a phone and wanting to check it. And, you know, for example, going on social media and then also contacting the plugs for for the various substances that his team would get Juice. I think that pretty effectively exemplifies sort of seeing the phone as something useful, you know, as a young person, but at the same time, something that just is a complete time sink and, you know, obviously poses a lot of potential connections to things that may not be all that beneficial for you, whether it's as, you know, trivial as wasting your time on, you know, reading and, you know, or playing or worrying about something that you shouldn't be spending your time on, to more severe instances, which is, I think, perfectly emulated in or perfectly depicted in Juice's case, where that's his reliance for the continuous supply of Percocet and you know, lean cough syrup, the cough syrup for the lean. But I thought it was interesting that Juice mentioned kind of having a jailbroken iPod Touch in the documentary, because I remember that was sort of the first desire as, you know, someone who's like 10, 11 years old, was not really to just have a fully functioning phone, but if I could have an iPod Touch, that was like the first, the handheld, you know, LCD smart device that I wanted to have. And the chief reason for that was listening to music. And the cameraman in that scene points out to Juice that, hey, you know, if there's one thing your phone is good for, it's listening to music. And I was absolutely on board with that. And I think Juice was too. That's why I mentioned the whole iPod Touch thing. But from a you know, more vague perspective, a broader perspective, I would most definitely say that a lot of people my age have that same bifurcation of views, or dichotomy of views on that phone. Is you know, it's useful, but nonetheless we look at it as something that is ultimately detrimental to physical, mental, emotional health. Yet I feel like there's a lot of people who just simply can't stop looking at them, can't put it down. And I don't know, I think it's important to acknowledge that.
Yeah, is dealing with multiple addictions, both technological and chemical. And another thing that reminded me of other figures we've talked about in the Let It Roll series is the way that I Love McKinnon and Cole Bennett both talk about Juice, is that they view him as a special person with a special mission. And, you know, that's very much the kind of thing that John Lennon heard all the time and believed himself. And Juice seemed to feel like his mission was to bring light to issues of mental health within the Black community, that he felt that, that mental health was something that was very stigmatized in the Black community, and he wanted to make it okay for people to admit they have problems so that they could get help. And it reminded me so much of John Lennon and Elvis Presley, both grappling with, you know, what do I do with this sudden fame and this mass audience? And all three of them concluded, I want to try to tell people positive messages. I mean, even Extensión, whose personal life was such a disaster, felt that same compulsion to try to communicate positive things. That seems to be, you know, one of the best ways to respond to finding yourself in that situation and dealing with that magnitude of talent and success. But then there's another interesting part in the movie where Kid Laroi has a major cameo all throughout the movie, and Trippy Redd's his manager and had made the hookup, and how do you see Kid Laroi in context of Juice WRLD's career and in context of the overall rap scene? Like, was this, you know, was he a free rider that's hitching on, or was he genuinely a talented contemporary that appear musically of Juice WRLD?
I see Kid Laroi, especially after watching the documentary, I see him now as a protege of Juice WRLD's. And before that, before I really knew the impact that Juice had, not only on the Kid Laroi, but also himself personally, but on his career, as in part of Laroi's ascension to mainstream fame in the 2020s and his, you know, his fan base of young kids this time, is the fact that he was able to meet with and record music with Juice WRLD. You know, their first collaboration, Go, was released in the wake of Juice WRLD's death. And I didn't necessarily get the sense that Kid Laroi was a hanger-on like the multitude of people that we saw in the Lil Peep documentary. But it seemed like he was an up-and-coming artist from Australia who was not very well known before 2019, really. And I think that collaboration with Juice WRLD, him meeting him and his production team, and sort of the resulting connections Laroi gained from that, allowed him to use that foothold that he got with, you know, meeting with and collaborating with Juice WRLD, to grow his own platform and, you know, gain a higher level of fame, especially after Juice's death. Not to say that Juice's death sparked fame itself for the Kid Laroi, but I think having that posthumous feature and then posthumous feature with Juice, and then other recorded music as well, because Juice, you know, had pretty much an entire vault's worth of unreleased music at the time of his death. I think that definitely helped Laroi's career. I saw him not necessarily as an industry plant, but as someone who definitely gained a lot of the necessary connections within the industry with not only certain artists, but key managerial figures as well. That is definitely what helped Laroi's ascension to commercial fame in the latter decade.
Yeah, another thing I noticed about, and this was true in all three of the movies, and I find it to be kind of heartening, having been telling this Let It Roll story, which is so many ways the story of American music is the story of the relationship of African Americans and Anglo Americans and Jewish Americans and other ethnicities. But it seems like in the modern era, I was heartened to see that all of these guys had integrated posses, that their core people were very multiracial. And yet the African-American figures seemed to have their hands on the till from a business perspective, or at least we're not getting screwed over. It wasn't a paternal system like you might have seen with Chess Records and Chuck Berry in the 50s, or, you know, even worse, the way that somebody like Burt Williams was treated in the 19-teens, or the way Louis Armstrong was treated in the 20s and 30s. So that's heartening to see. And I mean, do you think that's me being naive and idealistic, or do you think that things are actually somewhat improving as far as race relations amongst Zoomers?
I think that there's definitely more of a sense of integration and racial diversity, not only within the dynamics of the music industry that we've seen in all of, with in the case of all these artists, and obviously multitudes more currently, but also within sort of the Gen Z community and younger generations as well. Not only, you know, from my own life experiences, but also from the experiences of others that when I've been talking with people, I think there's definitely a heightened sense of general, someone's ethnicity doesn't necessarily dictate, whether or not, who they hang out with. I think at this point from a young age, a lot of times it's proximity based, and, I think that's pretty evident with Juice WRLD as well, because a lot of the artists that he first collaborates with are artists from Chicago, or not collaborates with, but artists that basically Juice WRLD first became known to, if that makes any sense. The likes of G Herbo and Lil Bibby, who signed him to Grade A Productions before he got signed to Interscope. But that's just an example of, it's more so, I think, an instance of proximity that determines sort of the formation of not only groups of friends, but also these music entourages. And a lot of time, the ethnicity of everyone is more or less indeterminate, which is, which is good that's not a considering factor in terms of, is this person, part of our group? It's more so also what they bring to the table that determines that collective molding with like a group of people in general. And I think that's obviously present in the Juice WRLD documentary.
All right, and let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk more about the magnitude of success the Juice WRLD experienced and some of his adventures with Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them? was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So one of the things I think the documentary does a really good job of is emphasizing the magnitude of his popularity. And it seems like virtually every time Juice WRLD performs a song in the movie, they list the numbers of streams, you know, plays on Spotify and other streaming services, as well as the number of YouTube plays. And we're talking hundreds of millions of streams, even billions of streams sometimes. Now, when they say something's been streamed a billion times, that doesn't mean a billion people listen to it. That's more like, say, 10 million people listening to it a few hundred times each. Is that a correct assumption?
I would say more or less, or you know, somewhere between 10 million listening 100 times, 100 million listening 10 times. It really depends on, you know, how much of a fan they are of Juice's music, how much they like a particular song, but it's almost never a billion separate people. It's more so, you know, people who are aware of Juice WRLD, are a known, not maybe not fan of his, but are at least aware of his music, and they, you know, listen to his songs a few times. That's what really generates those streaming numbers.
Yeah, and it's also very global. Is that correct?
I would definitely say so. I think a lot of the most streamed artists right now, and the artists that have broken the most records with respect to streaming history, and just the sheer volume of the numbers have reached throughout a lot of the, you know, most populated countries, and countries where, you know, streaming services and, you know, just having the likes of Apple Music, Tidal, Spotify, Amazon Music, having those as just sort of a proxemic way of enjoying media is commonplace. So, you know, US, Europe, a lot of places in Southeast Asia, a lot of places in Central and South America, well, pretty much the world over at this point, but definitely an international, a more international scene when you're such a highly streamed artist. The streams become a lot more global from a multitude of different areas.
And along with those streams came a lot of money. And so we see Juice, you know, buying dirt bikes and playing with pretty cool lightsaber toys, but several of his associates mentioned that he really doesn't spend his money that crazy. But one thing that's kind of ominous is that there's this conversation about him wanting to buy a private jet. And one of the people that he's with is explaining to him how much more economical it is just to lease a private jet or rent a private jet. And ultimately that's going to come back to haunt Juice WRLD in a really tragic sense. But what was your take on Juice WRLD's materialism? I mean, did he seem especially materialistic for somebody that was making this kind of money, or did it seem like he had it kind of under control, at least the acquisitions and the materialism?
I think it depicted on Juice's behalf about an average amount of, you know, if I had the money that Juice was getting from the not only from the record deal, but just from the global attention by the end of 2018 and into 2019, I would say he about met but didn't necessarily exceed expectations with respect to his material wealth. Granted, you know, there are the scenes with his really fancy gated home in Los Angeles, the numerous dirt bikes and four-wheelers that he had, as well as, you know, you mentioned the lightsabers. This seems like a lot of things that, you know, like your average teenager, if they had a lot of money, or, you know, a young guy would really enjoy having. But it didn't necessarily seem to dominate a good portion of the documentary. Granted, there was that one scene with the private jet you mentioned, where a G5 Gulfstream cost $20-30 million, and Juice is, you know, egging on someone off camera, one of his team, about how, oh, you know, I found this 2003 G5 for a decent price. But it didn't seem like Juice was an extremely material person. A lot of the scenes that, and a lot of that is because that's sort of superseded in a way, that sense of materialism, by the more prominently placed instances of substance abuse that we talked about. And I think that's a factor playing into it, is the emphasis on material wealth in terms of the way it was actually presented and what he was, you know, actually buying, you know, that was physical, I feel like manifested itself a lot less than the likes of buying drugs and the kind of the prevalence of them in every recorded scene from the documentary. At least that was my own personal impression of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's maybe two scenes where he's sort of acknowledging that he has a problem or saying he wants to do less of them. There's some mention from Allie of how she's banned Lean from the house and is trying to cut, you know, the codeine cost syrup out of his life. But then his, you know, personal assistant's talking about how he would sneak the Lean to Juice. And it reminded me so much of Elvis and Dr. Nick. Dr. Nick was a Greek doctor who kind of became the scapegoat for Elvis Presley's death. But many people feel like Dr. Nick was actually kind of the gatekeeper who was limiting the amount of drug abuse that Elvis could do. And it seemed like his assistants saw themselves in that same capacity, where Juice would ask for 4 ounces of Lean to be poured into a Sprite, and they would just give him 1 ounce, which, I mean, 4 ounces of codeine in a soft drink, is that's just Herculean amounts. And if you're mixing that with Xanax or something, you're really playing with your own life. And as obviously it came to haunt Juice. But the other thing that reminded me of Elvis was that he talks about this persistent sense of unreality, and that he acknowledges this is happening, but at the same time, he I think it's I Love McKinnon that he says, you know, I feel like I could just wake up and it's all going to be a dream. And that was exactly what Elvis Presley, and one of the reasons Elvis Presley stuck with the infamous Colonel Tom Parker, is he felt that Tom Parker was the one who made it real, who made it happen, and that if he lost Tom Parker, you would lose everything. But let's go ahead and hear another one from Juice WRLD. This is Robbery.
She told me put my heart in the bag, and nobody gets hurt. Now I'm running from your love. I'm not fast, so I'm making it worse. Now I'm digging up a grave for my past. I'm a whole different person. It's a gift and a curse.
And that was Robbery from Juice WRLD. And why did you just like this particular track?
This track actually brings me back to the days of senior year, when this was probably the one song out of all the songs that we've heard in these three Kings of Emo Rap episodes that everyone around me really loved. And so many of my friends that I wouldn't expect to be fans of Juice WRLD were playing his music in the car when we were driving to go get lunch during our off-campus lunch breaks. And Robbery was the one song that was sort of, it was an anthem, really, that I think everyone knew the lyrics to, and no matter who it was, they'd sing along when someone would put it on the aux. And also, it's just, it's one of my personal favorite Juice WRLD songs. In the, you know, in the years after high school, my taste sort of deviated from a lot of the artists that I was listening to at the time, who would be classified as emo rap or emo rap parallel, like Juice and Lil Uzi Vert and XXXTentacion. But Robbery was really the almost like the nadir of that era of my personal life, and for the lives of my friends, where we enjoyed that music. And it was directly prior to Juice's death as well, which was obviously very jarring amongst my generation.
Yeah, I gotta, you know, I feel guilty for having brought Zoomers into the world almost because of the world you guys are inheriting. And the And it struck me before, and I think I mentioned in one of these earlier episodes, but the emotional tone of so much of this music, and not just these guys, but, you know, even Billie Eilish, you know, even here in Katy Perry or Taylor Swift, sometimes there's just this overtone of despair that makes perfect logical sense when you look at the condition of the world. But there's this one line from Robbery that I thought was really clever and wanted to share. And they said, "She told me to put my heart in the bag and nobody gets hurt." I just thought that was a great metaphor for a great love song. And I can't believe nobody has done this before. I mean, how did Irving Berlin not think to compare love to armed robbery? It's I don't know. I thought that one was a really clever lyric.
Absolutely.
And I can see where it would have meant so much to kids in your generation. And that's the thing. It's like these people are really speaking for a generation, and it's so odd to me because I associate this kind of depressive music with people like Syd Barrett after he had been kicked out of Pink Floyd, or Alex Chilton as he's making Big Star's last album, or Nick Drake, who, you know, infamously sold maybe 600 records while he was alive and ODs, and then becomes a legend. But this stuff is now in the mainstream, and I think it behooves everybody to pay attention to what kids are listening to and what is the mood of this generation. And it's just it's just not pretty, you know. And the music is pretty, the music is beautiful, but what's being expressed is very sad and very concerning. But then the rest of the movie, it just continues, this momentum keeps going. And at one point, Juice talks about how he hasn't slept in 4 days, and for a guy who's drinking lean and taking Percocet, how on earth is he staying up this long? Was he also doing cocaine, or do we have any idea of the kind of chemical mix, or was he just really working that hard and had that much endurance to go that hard? Because when they talks about his schedule, I mean, you know, 4 days straight, traveling the country, hitting radio stations, doing in-persons, jumping into the studio and dropping lots of tracks. Like you said, he had vaults of tracks. They show him at the radio station doing multiple lyrics to the same beats. They said that, you know, when he was in the studio, he would frequently drop five complete different sets of verses and choruses to the same beat. I mean, you know, no, it's no wonder he's been a posthumous goldmine. It's incredible the amount of stuff he put out. But do you feel like with Avicii, say, the EDM producer who passed away in 2018, it was pretty clear from the documentary that he was sort of being, I wouldn't say deliberately worked to death by his management, but that there was very little concern for his health and safety on the part of his management, who just wanted him out there playing shows and making money. Do you feel like Juice was being pushed into this level of creativity, or do you feel like he was driven internally?
From my perspective of a lot of the scenes on the documentary, Henry of Juice in the studio with members of his team and with different producers like a DJ Scheme, Rex Kudo, Nick Mira, obviously. You know, that was a big one. It seems like Juice really is the driving force behind his own desire to, you know, we see to keep recording. I remember in multiple scenes, Juice is basically in the, you know, in the studio. He seems, you know, practically sort of disassociative. And he's next to the mixing engineer or the, you know, one of the producers. And then all of a sudden he'll just sit up and say, okay, let's do one more track. Or can you put on another beat for me? Like, I'm going to do some more verses. And I made particular note of that because it almost always caught me off guard. It seemed like he was in one instance, a really low energy person who didn't really seem grounded in his reality. And then the next instant he would sit up and really seem to want to do a verse. And I think part of it was definitely his label head, Lil Bibby, at the very end of the documentary mentions that he always thought that Juice would, he never doubted Juice in terms of his ability to blow up and go commercial. So there was no doubt that the likes of G Money and Lil Bibby, who are the, you know, the co-founders of Grade A Productions, the first label, that the collective that signs Juice WRLD in 2017, there was no doubt that they encouraged him to perform and to not only to perform, but to record music on a consistent basis. But Juice seems like one of those artists that was really driven by his own desire to spread awareness about mental health, especially anxiety in the Black community, like he talks about. And then also the sort of impact that he has on the kids, especially shown in the scene with the youth outreach programs. All of that, I think, really added fuel to the fire that that was that inspiration to make more music for Juice. And that was something that was really admirable about him, was not only could he, you know, instantaneously, you know, pull off a freestyle off the top of his head like he does in a couple of the different radio shows and interviews that are shown in the documentary. He's also inspired to do it, I feel like, mainly of his own volition, because of the catharsis and the relief it gives himself with performing music. It seems like that was one of the central points of the documentary, was that Juice, you know, Jared Higgins, was always someone who really enjoyed music and recognized his talent at it. And that was what kept inspiring him to, you know, do five verses at once or rap over nine different beats, because he really understood his passion and he understood his knack for it. And even with all the, you know, issues with substance abuse, especially the depressants and the, you know, just all the different ones, that didn't really, that hindered it less than I thought it would, because of Juice's own desires to really, you know, go his upward trajectory as an artist was, I think, inspiring to himself as well.
And let's go ahead and hear our last song. This is Bandit by Juice WRLD.
I don't need no Molly to be savage. When I'm on that Molly, I feel savage. She the definition of a bad bitch. Stole her. I'm the definition of a bandit. I don't need no Molly to be savage.
That's Juice WRLD's Bandit. And Ivan, why did you pick this one?
I picked this one because this was the last, well, not only alongside Robbery, was it one of the songs that I heard almost every day in the car with my friends, but it was also the last song released while Juice was still alive that really made an impact. It was it peaked at number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100, and also I think the NBA YoungBoy collab was a pretty landmark collaboration with respect to different areas of interest within hip hop, because NBA YoungBoy has a cult following of its own as well.
And tell us about NBA YoungBoy and what school of hip hop he comes from and how it differs from that sort of emo rap school that Juice WRLD was rapping.
Well, NBA YoungBoy is from Louisiana, I believe. And from my own perspective, he encompasses this sort of deep South, you know, modern neo trap music with a pretty unique approach to, you know, not only cadences, but also subject matter. The main thing I think everyone, you know, distinguishes YoungBoy for is his diehard fan base of people who think his music is really good. And a lot of that is because of the mass of people who don't necessarily like his music. But it's a lot more, hard and rhythm driven than a subgenre like, for example, emo rap or some other alternative forms of hip hop. And I feel like NBA YoungBoy is a little bit more conventional, but has a raw appeal. I think that's what cultivates his fan base. And I think the hard hitting nature of this track, it's a bit different from a lot of the other Juice WRLD songs we've heard. That really shines here. And Juice does as well. It's an interesting molding of styles in this particular track.
Yeah, and it really kind of makes you, it's poignant because you makes you wonder what could have happened and the kind of collaborations that Juice WRLD could have gone on and the kind of influences he could have absorbed. And would you say it's fair to say that NBA YoungBoy's fan base is, and posse and crew even, are more purely African-American than than the emo rappers, and that maybe it's more of a class difference. That NBA YoungBoy kind of represents the Black working class and even underclass, whereas Juice WRLD and Extension and Lil Peep kind of represented a more integrated middle class.
I would say so, although I have a relatively limited knowledge of NBA YoungBoy myself, but from
which is telling in itself.
And you're correct about that. So, you know, I would say generally, yes. But I also think the likes of X and Juice WRLD had a much larger reach in general. However, I think their issues addressing the stigma of mental health was a little bit more generalized. And then also, I feel like a lot of the middle class and a lot of, you know, a lot of white kids listening to emo rap, I feel like resonated with those like internal struggles. That's really what brought such the variety of fans from different backgrounds, from different classes, areas of the world.
And then the video takes sort of an ominous turn towards the end there's more and more shots of Juice taking more and more pills. I mean, at one point he sticks his tongue out. I think there's like 7 or 8 Percocets on his tongue. He's pressing his handlers to give him, you know, like I said, a can of Sprite that's a quarter lean or a third lean, you know, just crazy dosage. But then it's always ominous when you're watching a documentary or reading a book and suddenly they start talking about the day-to-day, like the minute-by-minute activities on a particular day. You almost always know when a day is documented that well that something horrible happened. And sure enough, Juice ends up leasing a plane, rents a private plane. He and his entourage are like 6 hours late getting to the plane. The pilot's unhappy. Turns out the pilot calls the police. The police are waiting for him when they land in Chicago. What happens when they land and the police are waiting for him?
Basically, everything just blows to smithereens. When they land, they see the constables and sheriff's car outside. What's it called? Juice's head of security talks about seeing the cops and not really thinking much of it because, you know, Henry Dean, his head of security, is asking the pilots about, you know, what's going on when he sees the cop cars. They don't really say that anything is wrong in response, even though the security is sort of, he's concerned, although it's pretty normal to have that police escort from what they mentioned in the documentary from earlier tours and shows. There's even, you know, a scene of a couple police in the backstage at Camp Flognaw. But in this case, it's for, you know, it's for an arrest. It's for apprehending people. So when they land, Juice starts having a seizure. And it's basically a mixture of lean and Percocet. And they find a whole myriad of things in the toxicology report in the aftermath that they show from one of the news clips covering Juice's death that day, spoiler alert. But a lot of people like the Kid Laroi and Juice's managers are, one of Juice's managers is on that flight. Juice starts seizing, you know, goes into shock, and, you know, everyone is really concerned, talking about getting him to the hospital. But I remember the Kid Laroi talks about the seizure as if it were one thing, and then talks about the blood coming out of Juice's nose and mouth in that same moment as if it were a whole other, like a, you know, a whole new level of crisis. And that's when everyone, he mentions, that's when everybody started freaking out. Juice called out for Allie right before going into shock. The cops come on, when the plane, you know, door opens, the cops arrest everybody except for Allie. And, you know, keep saying Juice WRLD's all right. They try and get him to the hospital, but they don't, the police nor you know anybody else really acts quickly enough to get Juice out of there to save him, and he passes away after having that seizure. And they find the likes of THC, morphine, hydro and oxycodone, as well as promethazine, codeine. And it is crazy that one day of being arrested, the entire team being arrested right as Juice is going into shock. On top of the fact that they found like 70 pounds of weed and 3 firearms, 6 bottles of codeine in their luggage around that time, which revealed kind of the basis for why they were apprehending everyone. But still, really, everything just blows up in Juice and his team's face at once, and it results in the death of Juice WRLD as well.
Yeah, and I think it's especially stressful to me to just my familiarity with police in this country, having no concern for the life of somebody, presumably just because they had marked him as a quote unquote bad guy, since they were there to search the plane and ended up, finding, contraband and making arrests. But it's just so maddening. Had this been Kid Rock or somebody like that, I do not think the police would have just watched them die like that. And it's kind of back to the endless American tragedy that somebody like Juice WRLD, as famous as he was, as beloved as he was by so many people, and yet, push comes to shove, the police don't care and watch him die. And again, given the amount of drugs and the mix of drugs in the system, maybe there was nothing that could have been done. And his own, entourage, multiple people say, listen to his songs. I mean, he, Little Bibby, his label head, said, he cites the number that he says he wanted to die over 30 times in his songs. And that Little Bibby says that, since he was freelancing, it's coming right off of his head and presumably, spoke from his heart. So that they think that was a suicidal drive there as well. But there was something else that I think it was Cole Bennett said, that, that he was sort of taking the sunny side up view, that Juice WRLD's legacy, that anytime right now there are people listening to Juice WRLD, there are thousands or millions of people right this second as we speak, as you listen, listening to Juice WRLD. And he seems to think that, as long as people exist, people will be listening to Juice WRLD. I tend to believe that as long as Spotify exists, as long as these streaming services exist, people will be listening to Juice WRLD. I just wish I was more confident that we were going to have the energy, resources, and the internet connections to share this music. But what do you feel about the whole nature of musical immortality? Is it worth, is it a fair trade-off to shorten your life that much, to only get 21 years on Earth, if that means that people are going to be listening to your music as long as we can see, for the any visible time horizon, or is it just a waste and a tragedy?
It's a difficult question, because I definitely think in Juice's case, this immortal superstardom was definitely, the propulsion of it was heightened in the wake of his death. That's when really all eyes flocked to Juice WRLD, that, if someone wasn't listening to him before, they were now, especially in the wake of his death. I'm trying to classify Juice WRLD as, when he was alive, he was someone who was considered, in the spotlight, in the form of regular stardom, but wasn't necessarily immortalized. I think I looked at him as another rapper who was talented and had a large fan base, had commercial success, was likely on his way up. But it was really, I think, that death that basically solidified him as one of the most streamed artists of the 2010s. Don't get me wrong. I think that, he had a very emotionally dedicated fan base, as have all three of these artists that we've covered in the Three Kings of Emo Rap series. They've all exhibited that, very loyal fan bases. But I don't necessarily know that immortalization was worth it. I think that was one of the most haunting parts of not only Juice's repeated references in his songs to not making it past 21, but also the fate of him, Lil Peep, and XXXTentacion occurring at that age of 21 years old, or 20, which is my age. And when I think about it from that perspective, that I am the, you know, I'm the same age as all these artists were more or less when they passed away. I don't think that that reverence, that immortalization is really worth cutting short the lives of people who would have the opportunity to change so many more lives if they were still alive necessarily, and continue to like actively influence the output of their music, you know, shaping the world as they would want it to be.
Yep, I think that's a fair assessment. And so, Ivan, it's been a pleasure. My guest has been Ivan De Haas, the new intern for Let It Roll. And we've wrapped up the Three Kings of Emo Rap series. And one last question. With the death of Juice WRLD, was that kind of a death blow for the emo rap movement? Has anybody stepped up to kind of carry the torch, or has time passed on?
I really don't think there has been anybody within the vein of emo rap in the time since Juice WRLD's death that has shown a similar degree of popularity or influence. That's not to say that the genre isn't necessarily dead, but I definitely think with respect to, you know, the commercial perspective, so to speak, it has shifted, the spotlight has shifted off of this niche sonic alternative to regular hip hop. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But for now, I think the emo rap scene is not really having that spotlight shown on it as it was when Juice WRLD was alive.
And that's why we're covering it, because we do music history on Let It Roll. And so it's kind of sad to consign these young kids and this movement into history. But I think emo rap was a movement that had its day in the 2010s. And Ivan De Haas, thanks so much for coming on and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me, Nate. It was great.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate welcomes Kim Mack to discuss 90s alt metal group Living Color. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.